Okay, so I'm going to talk and work on the computer here at the same time. So this is Bio 241, the Monday-Wednesday class, and oh no, it's not the Monday-Wednesday class. It's a Tuesday-Thursday class. All right, well, that will work for me. Okay, and it's Thursday, the 22nd of January, and we're in the chemistry chapter. We'll finish up the chemistry chapter today. So let's recapitulate what we're thinking about already. We talked about the structure of atoms in here, subatomic particles, different shells of atoms, what makes one element different than another chemical element. The number of protons inside the nucleus, and what do we call that? What do we call the number of protons inside the nucleus that determines the element? That's called the, I'm not going to tell you. You'll have to look that up. Atomic number. Thank you. And, all right, so then we looked at some chemical bonds. What's the strongest chemical bond? Covalent. How would you describe very shortly what a chemical bond is? Covalent bond? Sharing of electrons. What's the next weakest kind of bond? Ionic bond. What happens there? What's being donated and accepted? An electron, yeah. All right, so don't forget, chemistry involves electrons, and electrons from, in particular, what part of the atom? The outer shell. What do we call that outer shell of electrons? That's the valence shell of electrons, right? That involves chemistry. All right, and then what's the weakest bond that we looked at? Hydrogen bonds. And that's because water has that funny, not responding, has that little funny attribute, even though water is not an ion, it still has polarity because oxygen pulls electrons to itself. It denudes the protons of electrons, and so the protons on either end of the water molecule have a little positive charge, and that oxygen ends up with a little negative charge. Okay. All right, let me come back and see if it finds itself. Maybe it won't. I'm not sure. All right, then we started talking about pH. What's a pH a measure of? Acidity, right? And what is the actual chemical compound that that relates to acidity? Hydrogen ions. And what do we call that measure of hydrogen ions? When we actually measure the pH of something. Oh, sorry. I gave you the answer. It's called pH, right? When you measure the hydrogen ion concentration, you report that concentration in terms of pH. All right? So as the hydrogen ion concentration increases in solution, what happens to the acidity? Okay, I don't know anybody. Nobody's yelling the answer out. Somebody's got to yell the answer out so I can hear. As hydrogen ion concentration increases, what happens to acidity? Does it go up or go down? It goes up, right? As hydrogen ion concentration increases, acidity increases. But what about the pH number? It goes down, and that's because acidity and pH are inversely related to each other because of that pH formula. Let's see if we can get at least the PowerPoints working here. Okay. So we talked about some acids and some bases. What do you get when you add an acid to a base? What do you get? You get water. Yeah, they neutralize each other, right? Okay. And so at what pH is the hydrogen ion concentration equal to the hydroxide concentration? At pH 7, right? Right at pH 7. All right. Oh, this is looking good. We got the first slide. All right. Then we started talking about different kinds of molecules, organic molecules. We defined what an organic molecule is. What the heck is an organic molecule again? It's got to have a carbon covalently bound to a hydrogen. So give me an example of a very important biological molecule, but one that is not organic, one that is inorganic. H2O, perfect example, because it doesn't have carbon. It's got hydrogen, but no carbon. What's another good example of an inorganic molecule that's very important in our body? Carbon dioxide. It is inorganic as well. Okay, then we started talking about the organic compounds. And the table that you see on the screen right there, that defines what chemical symbols you have to know compared to their English word. Right? Make sure you memorize columns 1 and 2. You don't have to memorize column number 3 over here. All right, so what are the four kinds of important organic biochemicals in our body? The four major classes. Well, those are elements. Carbon, hydrogen are elements, but the classes of organic compounds, the major classes. Carbohydrates, lipids, proteins, and nucleic acids. Right, so I think we got to proteins. We talked about carbohydrates. Why do we call those chemical compounds carbohydrates? Because for every carbon atom, I guess I'm going to start the slideshow now. For every carbon atom, there's an H2O associated with it. It's a carbon hydrate in those particular ratios. All right, so glucose is an example of what kind of carbohydrate? Monosaccharide, right? It's a simple sugar. Can you give me an example of a disaccharide? Sucrose, yeah, okay. And how would we put two monosaccharides together to make a disaccharide? What kind of chemical reaction would we use? Dehydration synthesis. How would you break a disaccharide apart? Or how does our bodies do that? Hydrolysis reaction, right, okay. All right, so is that just something you have to memorize for carbohydrates, or do those reactions work for lipids as well? Yeah, because how... Give me the name of a compound that is of a lipid that is synthesized by dehydration synthesis reaction. A triglyceride. Yeah. So then you should know what the building blocks of a triglyceride are. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? Glycerol and three fatty acids. All right. So it looks like you guys are spending some time with this information. That's good. Oh, and then we talked last time a lot about this phospholipid molecule, which is very interesting. Okay, why is the phospholipid molecule very interesting? Because it has two important domains in one molecule. It's both hydrophilic and hydrophobic. So one end of the molecule wants to associate with water, and what part is that? The phosphate head group, right? And the long hydrocarbon chains don't want to have anything to do with water, right? And the phospholipid is a basic building block of any kind of membrane, so like a cell membrane, for instance. Okay. Okay. And so proteins. You should know the general shape of an amino acid. There are 20 common amino acids that are in our body. They all have this general formula right here. And how could you describe to me that this indeed is an amino acid? What kind of functional groups does it have? It has an R group, which means what? What does that R mean? Okay, the R group right here means that it's variable. R is not a chemical symbol for anything. R just means that it can take many different kinds of forms. Right? And so if this molecule right here can take many different kinds of forms, what can you tell me about the function of an amino acid? Yeah, it changes whenever we change this R group right here. It has different functions. All right, and we call this an amino acid because there is an amino group on one end and a carboxyl group on the other. And what can you tell me about the nature of that carboxyl group? It's an acidic group, so therefore we call this an amino acid just because of that. All right, now did I mention that last time? I think I did, right. All right. The other important thing is that there is this central carbon, sometimes we call this an alpha carbon, that binds the carboxyl group, the amino group, and this variable group. So this is just the central carbon. All right, so if we substitute this hydrocarbon chain right here for R, this is what we would call valine, and notice this is just a very large nonpolar group. right? There are no phosphoruses here, no nitrogens in there. There's no hydroxyl functional groups. So this will want to associate with other kinds of nonpolar side chains on a protein as it's being built. Tyrosine is another kind of amino acid, but you see the same general structure down here, the alpha carbon, the carboxyl group, and the amino group right here. And the variable group now is a nonpolar ring, hydrocarbon ring. It does have this OH group, but it's, still, this is a nonpolar amino acid. And then we have some polar amino acids. Now we should start to see a lot of oxygens and nitrogens that form covalent kinds of, polar kinds of covalent bonds. All right, so because there's a high degree of variability between different amino acids, proteins can have many different kinds of shapes and many different kinds of functions in the body, more so than pretty much any other group of compounds that we've looked at so far. All right, and if we want to join two amino acids, guess what kind of chemical reaction your body employs to join amino acids together? Dehydration synthesis reaction, the same thing over and over and over again. So here you see an OH on one amino acid, an H on the next amino acid. That can be pulled off to form water, namely a dehydration. That forms a nice peptide bond. So a peptide bond has this kind of structure right here. All right, so here is the first amino acid, the second amino, the third amino acid, and the fourth amino acid. So now we have three peptide bonds holding this polypeptide chain together. So again, proteins, just like polysaccharides, are polymers, repeating units over and over and over again. So a protein is just a repeating unit of different kinds of amino acids over and over and over again. It's just a chain of amino acids. And if the chain is less than 100 amino acids long, sometimes we call that a polypeptide. If it's over 100 amino acids long, then we call that a protein. So we can talk about the structure of a protein, all right? And so we're interested in talking about the structure because some proteins are structural in nature, but some proteins are functional in nature. So if we change the structure of a protein, then what is going to be the end result? The function of that protein is going to change as well. So we got to define the structure of a particular protein, and the primary structure is just the sequence of amino acids, which amino acids are joined together to form a polypeptide or a protein. And so what do I see? I see one, I see two, I see three amino acids in this chain right here. And it could be any one of the 20 amino acids. Like this could be valine, valine, valine. This could be valine, glycine, tyrosine, for instance. And then that will determine what the primary structure of this particular amino acid is. All right, so think of an amino acid as a link in a chain. And a chain is going to, the whole length of that chain is going to be a protein. Or you could think of a protein as being a word, and what are the letters in this word that's a protein? What are the letters? The letters are the amino acids that make that word up, right? So this could be A, B, C, but it's going to have different names depending on the amino acids. So that's the primary structure. So the primary structure is a building block for something. And it's the building block for something we call the secondary structure. And the secondary structure has a more three-dimensional shape to it. It's just not the linear sequence of amino acids. But if certain amino acids are joined together in just the right way, when it's made, it comes out to form this nice coil right here. Now, we don't call that a coil. We call that the alpha helix. And this is going to give some kind of structure or shape to the protein. There can be another kind of secondary structure that is not a coil, but it looks more like an accordion, something like this with sharp edges on it. This is what we call the beta pleated sheet. And this is, again, another example of secondary structure that makes up our protein. Okay? These two things, alpha helix and beta pleated sheet, are secondary structure. All right, so here is a nice diagram of kind of a complicated protein, hundreds of amino acids long, and you can see that there are segments of alpha helix right here, right? And then long segments where there is no alpha helix or even beta pleated sheet. So think of this polypeptide as a long string. Oh, here's a little rubber band right here that's been broken, right? So the primary structure, all the amino acids that make up the string right here, and if there is an alpha helix, you would take this rubber band and just kind of coil it around your finger. That would be the secondary structure. The tertiary structure, right, includes the complete three-dimensional shape of this protein. And that includes the alpha helix, or maybe there might be a region of beta pleated sheet. Right? And tertiary structure is caused by bending and folding of the polypeptide chain to produce this shape right here. Some proteins are very long and narrow. Some are very globular in nature. Some have little pockets in them. It all depends on how the polypeptide chain forms and bends as it's being built. All right, and for instance, this top loop right here approximates this little strand behind it. All right, so there has actually got to be an association of amino acids in this region of the protein compared to what's right underneath it. So for instance, if there are a number of amino acids that are highly ionic in nature or polar in nature right here, guess what you might see in amino acids that are right behind this loop. So if this loop has a number of polar amino acids, then what kind of amino acids will want to associate with this region right here? Should they be nonpolar or polar kinds? They should be polar as well. All right? Or for instance, if this is a nonpolar region, then that little segment behind it should be nonpolar as well, because those compounds will attract each other. All right, so the shape of a protein is stabilized by weak bonds between various functional groups that are on different amino acids. So ionic interactions or polar interactions are pretty weak, and even hydrogen bonds are very weak. All right, so here is a protein that has this particular shape. And because the bonds are very weak, what can you tell me about the shape of that protein if we treat it roughly? Okay, yeah, you can change the shape of that particular protein. All right, so let's just say we start off with a protein that has this shape like this. All right, and we have it in water, and we start to heat that water. And what temperature is, I'm not sure anybody knows what temperature is, really, in terms of molecules. Temperature is just a measure of motion of molecules. So as the temperature increases, the motion of molecules increase. And a good way to kind of think of that is that when you heat water up, hotter and hotter and hotter, okay, the molecules start to move so fast that you get to a certain point, what happens to those molecules actually? They jump out of the water. What do we call that when water molecules jump out of water? That's boiling. Okay? So there are particular temperatures, or if we take a lot of heat out of water, it gets colder and colder and colder, the molecules slow down. Eventually what happens to them? They slow down so much that the water actually freezes. Right? So temperature is just a measure of molecular motion inside a solution. All right? So as we heat this molecule up, guess what it is doing as the temperature increases? It's moving. It's twisting and bending and vibrating. Okay? And if we heat this molecule up, okay, to the boiling point, it might move so much that, all right, it's going to change its shape. It's going to maybe look like something like that. Okay, and when that happens, when the protein changes shape so drastically, guess what? It can never go back to its original shape. So this is sometimes what we call the native configuration. All All right, native configuration, sometimes we say conformation, native conformation. It has this particular shape over here. And when we change the shape, this is this process, all right, so the reverse can't happen, only the forward direction can happen. This is what we call denaturation. And you're all familiar with that. So even if we take this protein that's been denatured and cool it down, it can never go back to its native configuration right here. Another important thing is that when we change the shape of this protein, or when we denature the protein, what happens to the function of this protein? It changes, and it, many times it's destroyed. Okay? So through evolution, the correct shape has been selected for a particular function, and when we change the shape, then that protein loses that particular function. Okay. And you're aware of that. You do that all the time. And so if a process can only go in one direction, all right, we say it is irreversible. Denaturation is irreversible. It can only go in one direction. We can cool it down, but we can't ever get that function back. So let's just say tonight you sit down and you're going to have a hamburger, and you put a hamburger on the grill, and it's almost done cooking, right? And then somebody gives you a phone call and says, hey, a pool table just opened up, and we need a fourth player. Come and shoot some pool with us. And you say, well, I just got done cooking my hamburger, and I'm going to have dinner. And they say, oh, well, you know what? You have your priorities out of line. And so what do they talk you into doing? Get going and shooting some pool, and you come back and have your hamburger later. So you take your cooked hamburger, and does the cooked hamburger look different than raw hamburger? I don't know if everybody in here knows. We might have some nice vegetarian folks in here. That's okay. All right, but a cooked hamburger looks a lot different than raw hamburger. So now you take your cooked hamburger, and you put it back in the refrigerator, and now it's at the same temperature that it was when it was raw. But does it look like raw hamburger, even though it's back in the refrigerator? No. Once it's cooked, right, it's denatured, and that protein will never go back to that native conformation. Okay. Because now all kinds of different ionic bonds and hydrogen bonds are established in this molecule. The native configuration is produced, or can be produced, only as the protein is being made, amino acid by amino acid by amino acid. It can't reach this configuration once the whole protein is assembled. All right, so that's the tertiary structure and some of the importance of tertiary structure of a protein. Then there's another structure. Well, no, actually, let's talk about this right here. So here we have a protein, and it's made up of all these thousands of amino acids, and we can see like a beta, an alpha helix right here. Okay, so why is it that we can have, for instance, this alpha helix? And what kind of structure is that alpha helix again called? It's a secondary structure. So what determines the secondary structure of this segment of the protein? And maybe, how about if I ask the question, what's the building block for secondary structure? Okay, and the way I want you to think is that the primary structure, right, the sequence of amino acids determines what the secondary structure is of a protein. So if we don't have the right amino acids next to each other, it can't form this coil right here. Right? And for instance, here we see now the tertiary structure of a protein. It's taking a three-dimensional shape. What is the building block of tertiary structure? Yeah, so it's going to be the secondary structure of the protein, and that's determined by the primary structure. So all the previous kinds of structures that we're talking about help determine what the eventual conformation can be of that particular protein. All right, so why is it that we have these hairpin loops in this particular protein? Well, we can explain it, for instance, by, well, here's an amino acid that has a carboxyl group. Here's an amino acid that has an amino group. All right, these are will form ions, and this can form a nice ionic bond between these two amino acids, which causes a kink in the protein right here. All right, and what's the strength of this bond right here, strong or weak? It's weak. It can be, all right, it can be broken just by boiling, for instance. And then after you cool the protein down, these two might not ever find each other again to form that particular kind of ionic bond. All right, here is a hydrogen bond, okay, between these two amino acids. That's going to cause a little bend in the protein right here. And that hydrogen bond is also what? Extremely weak. It can be broken by increasing the temperature of a solution. And then here is another kind of bond that I haven't talked about yet. And just like polar compounds will attract each other, nonpolar compounds can attract each other as well. So here are two ring structures. These are nonpolar groups. They have the same kind of nature. These are both hydrophobic groups. They will attract each other. And these are what we call van der Waals forces. These are even weaker than hydrogen bonds. All right, but they increase. If you have hundreds of van der Waals forces stabilizing a protein, that can give a lot of structure to a protein. And here you can see some other long hydrocarbon chains or no polar molecules right here. These two amino acids will be associated with each other, right, through van der Waals forces. Okay, so in your hierarchy of thinking of chemical bonds, a lot of people don't say that a van der Waals force is a chemical bond, but probably you should think of it as the weakest kind of chemical bond that we're going to run into in this class. So the strongest chemical bond is covalent. The next weakest is going to be ionic, then hydrogen bonds, and then the absolute weakest is going to be the van der Waals forces. And that's just an association of nonpolar groups. Okay, but nonetheless, that's going to help form the tertiary structure of a protein. And here we see an amino acid. This is going to be a cysteine amino acid here and here, which has an SH functional group on it, a sulfhydryl group. Well, these actually can form a bond, and the hydrogen can come off, and a hydrogen can come off, and will form a what we call a disulfide bridge. Now, this is a covalent bond. So what do you think the strength of this bond is, and how will it stabilize this protein molecule? Will it have a significant stabilizing effect, long-term effect, or can it be easily broken? It can't be easily broken, so it's going to have a long-term effect on this particular protein, right? And actually, you're pretty much all familiar with this because, well, let me just ask you, how many different kinds of human hair are there, like on our head? Oh, there's thousands of different kinds of human hair, right? As opposed to being like thin or thick hair, but in terms of like straightness or the curliness of it, right? There could be absolutely straight, or you could have a light kind of wave in your hair. You can have really curly hair. You can have kinky wavy, right? You can have kinky curly. You can have many, many different kinds of curls to your hair. And the reason why hair is curly is because of these disulfide bridges or bonds that are formed between different protein chains within somebody's hair, right? So if you have really curly hair, you have a lot of these disulfide bonds between the proteins in a hair fiber. And if your hair is really, really straight, super straight, you probably have hardly no disulfide bonds between carbon proteins in your hair. And this is the only time that I can think of when denaturation is reversible. Usually denaturation is irreversible. And the example would be when somebody gets a permanent in their hair. So what happens? Well, some fairly rough chemicals are applied to break all of these disulfide bonds between the proteins in somebody's hair, and then you put the hair in the kind of shape you want, and then you use some other chemicals to build these disulfide bonds back up, and so now hair kind of takes on the shape of the curls or whatever, right? But it's not a gentle kind of process. I'm not familiar with it, but I would guess it's fairly radical treatment to your hair. All right, so you actually denature your hair to get a permanent, but also you can you can reduce that permanent, right? You can go back and reapply those chemicals in the right process, and I don't know what you have to do to get rid of a permanent, if you have to, like, straighten all your hair out or whatever, but, right, you can get back to the native conformation of that particular protein. That's the only circumstance that I'm aware of that denaturation is reversible. If you think of any others, please let me know. Okay, so all of these different kinds of bonds are used to give a protein a particular shape, which then eventually is going to translate into a particular function. All right, and the last kind of structure of a protein is what we call quaternary structure. Some proteins, for instance, are not just one polypeptide or one protein, they're actually an accumulation of proteins that come together and associate with each other. So, for instance, hemoglobin is an important protein, and hemoglobin has actually four proteins, four independent proteins that make it up, right? And so when we have to join a number of polypeptide chains through covalent bonds, right, that determines the quaternary structure of a protein. And hemoglobin even has some other additional requirements for it to work. Right in the center of each one of these subunits right here, there has to be an iron atom. So here I see an iron atom. I see one back here, one over here, and one over here. And so that allows hemoglobin to bind oxygen and carry oxygen in our blood. Okay, so you got primary. So what is the building block of quaternary structure? What allows this real fancy protein to be made? It is the, let's go back, let's just go back one step. I like the way you're thinking, but the building block for quaternary structure is tertiary structure. In order for these four molecules to come together, right, each one of those subunits has to have the right fit to each other. And so that would be the tertiary structure. And the tertiary structure is dependent on having the right secondary structure. And the secondary structure can only be built if the protein has the correct sequence of amino acids. That's the primary structure, right? So quaternary structure is dependent on tertiary structure. Tertiary structure is dependent on secondary structure. And secondary is determined by just the sequence of amino acids in a protein, and that is the primary structure of that particular protein. So think of it in terms of those building blocks. Okay. All right, so once a protein is made, it can be modified. Glycoproteins are proteins that have carbohydrates attached to them. Lipoproteins are proteins that have what attached to them? Lipids, for instance, some kind of lipid molecule. All right, and other kinds of proteins have other kinds of molecules associated with them, maybe a pigment, an iron molecule, like hemoglobin, like I showed you just a second ago. And we call it a pigment. Does anybody know what a pigment is? Before we flip away from this slide, what's a pigment? Pigment is something that gives color to a particular compound, right? If something is completely transparent, if light goes right through it, then it doesn't have any pigment to it at all. So, for instance, these chairs, and I'm really bad understanding pigments, right? That I told you guys, right? So these chairs look kind of yellow to me, right? So they're yellow because they have a yellow pigment in them. And blood looks red because there's a red pigment. There is a chemical that absorbs all colors that when it shine on it, except red. Red is reflected, and that's what your eye picks up, right? And it's that iron molecule, that iron atom inside hemoglobin that turns hemoglobin into a pigment. It gives it its properties of being a pigment. So hemoglobin absorbs all light except for red. Red is reflected off of it, and so that's what your eye picks up. So a pigment is just something that gives color to paints or fingernail polish or any kind of compound. And from anatomy, what's the pigment that is a natural sunscreen in our bodies that protects our integument from solar radiation? Melanin. Yeah, melanin has the ability to absorb the harmful rays of the sun. All right, so that's a pigment. So anything that absorbs light is a pigment. Okay. All right, nucleic acids. This is the fourth kind of organic compound. And a nucleic acid can either be DNA or RNA. And DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. And the ribo is comes from a term of sugar. Ribose is a sugar. We looked at a bunch of sugars that have six carbons in them. Ribose is a sugar that only has five. But what's going to be the ratio for every carbon atom in that five-carbon sugar? What is going to be attached to every carbon atom in that five-carbon chain? Phosphate? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just talking about for ribose, okay? Not for a nucleotide yet, but for ribose, I'm just going back to what a carbohydrate is. So if it's a five-carbon, right, if it's a C, yeah, right? So on one side, we're going to have an OH, and on the other side, we're going to have a H, right? And then over here, maybe we'll have an H, and then over here, OH, and ribose is a five-carbon with the proper conformation of OHs on the other sides of these carbon atoms right here, right? So don't forget, carbohydrate, like ribose, is a carbon hydrate. There's a water molecule attached to every carbon atom. Okay, so the important sugar in a nucleic acid is going to be either ribose or deoxyribose, depending on what exactly the nucleic acid is. All right, the building block of all nucleic acids, including DNA and RNA, are what we call nucleotides. So here's an example of a nucleotide. There is a phosphate group, and a phosphate group is just a PO4. I showed you a slide of that earlier. And this sugar, this monosaccharide, is not a six-carbon sugar, so it's not like glucose or fructose or galactose. It's a ribose sugar because it only has five carbons on it. And also attached to this carbon is going to be something that's very basic in nature, and so we call that a base. So a nucleotide has something that's very basic. It has a five-carbon sugar, a ribose derivative, and a phosphate group. So this is the building block of all nucleotides, of all nucleic acids. So what's the building block of protein? Amino acid. What's the building block of nucleic acid? Nucleotide. Here is the general formula for a nucleotide. All right, and the bases that we find in DNA, right, there can be only four. Now, in proteins, how many different kinds of amino acids did we have? Did I tell you? We didn't look at all of them. As a matter of fact, I'm not going to have you know the names probably of any of them, especially their structure. You don't have to know. We're going to talk maybe about a couple of them a little bit later in the class. But there are 20. All right. But in terms of nucleotides that make up DNA, there are only four. And here are their names: guanine, thymine, cytosine, and adenine. Right, so there's not a lot of variability in how we can substitute the base on this ribose sugar right here. Okay, so the nucleotide is a building block for DNA and RNA, or the nucleotide is a building block for nucleic acids. So how do you think you add nucleotides together? What kind of chemical reaction has evolution figured out to make a big long polymer out of something, out of repeating units over and over and over again? How would you join two nucleotides together? Okay. What kind of chemical reaction might you use? How would you put two monosaccharides together to form a disaccharide? A dehydration synthesis reaction. How would you take a glycerol and a fatty acid, or three fatty acids to make a triglyceride? You would use a dehydration synthesis reaction. If you want to put two amino acids together, what kind of reaction does your body use? Dehydration synthesis reaction. If your body wants to put two nucleotides together, take a guess on what kind of reaction that is. That is also a dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay? So, essentially, it's not very complicated. Okay. So dehydration synthesis reaction, and what gets joined are, all right, a nucleic acid is just a big, long molecule. It's a sequence of nucleotides. So it's similar to a protein, because a protein is just a sequence of amino acids together, all joined together via dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay. So a nucleic acid is a long string, alternating groups of phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, and then sticking out to the side are going to be the various bases that you have. And for DNA, these are the only bases. So I probably won't even say guanine anymore. I'll just say G. And thymine, I'll just say T. And what will I say for adenine? A. Okay. Am I just making this too simple? Are you falling asleep or no? Okay. All right. So this is going to be, for instance, one side of a DNA molecule. Let me see what this next slide looks like. Okay. The sugar in DNA, right, and I'll show you the exact structure in a little bit, is not a ribose sugar. All right, it's going to be missing an oxygen atom in one location, right in this location over here, and I'll show you a picture of that in a little bit. And since it's missing an oxygen atom, guess what we call this molecule? Then this is a deoxyribonucleotide, because it's going to miss that oxygen right there. But in RNA, that oxygen is present, so that's not a deoxyribose sugar. It's going to be actually a ribose sugar. So we call this this would be a ribonucleotide. Okay, so here we see the string of covalent bonds. Okay, and these are the three bases. And I'm not going to ask you to know which ones are purines and which ones are pyrimidines. You should just know that some are relatively large, some are relatively small, okay? And you don't have to know which one is which, but you will have to know what the bases are in DNA. Okay. So if we're going to put two strands together, right, if we're going to put two strands of these nucleic acids together, in order for them to fit together, all right, if we have a big base from this strand over here, guess what kind of base has to be on the other side? A small one. And if we have a big base over here, guess what we have to have on this side? A small one, right? There's no room in a double-stranded DNA molecule to put two big ones together. And if there are two small ones, they won't have the right association. It won't fit. It won't give the DNA molecule the right kind of shape. Furthermore, the bases, if we look at the bases guanine here and cytosine, we see that it can actually form hydrogen bonds between different functional groups on these bases. Right, so what can you tell me about these hydrogen bonds? They will help the approximation. It will bring these two strands of DNA together. All right, and it stabilizes the DNA molecule. But now how stable is it? How stable is a hydrogen bond? Even if you have three of them right here, they're still easily broken. So that's fortunate, because the double-stranded DNA molecule has to unzip in order for it to be used. And then after it's used and put away, guess what happens? The hydrogen bonds are formed again, and we have the original DNA molecule. So DNA can come apart and go back together again, and come apart and go back together again very easily. All right, so this is what we call the base pairing rules for DNA. So if on one strand there's a guanine molecule, it will only base pair with a cytosine. So guanine can't base pair with adenine, guanine can't base pair with thymine, because it doesn't have the right shape and it won't have the correct number of hydrogen bonds to form a DNA molecule. The other possibility is thymine, and thymine always base pairs with adenine. So those are the only kinds of base pairs. So we say GC and AT, or AT, GC, and it doesn't matter which one you say first. It really doesn't matter. So here is a nice DNA molecule. Let's look at the one on the right-hand side first. So if you look at a DNA molecule, you can see that it has two strands or two chains of nucleic acids that come together. All right, so here you see a phosphate and the deoxyribose, phosphate deoxyribose, and probably that little circle right there. Oh, no, never mind. Okay, deoxyribose, phosphate deoxyribose. All right, this forms the backbone of the DNA molecule. And what kind of structure, what kind of household item does this double-stranded DNA molecule kind of look like to you? It looks like a ladder. I heard ladder someplace way back up over there. And indeed, it is a ladder. Okay, think of it as a ladder. The handrails here are made up of the phosphate and deoxyribose sugars, and the steps are made out of what? The bases, right? Because the bases are sticking to the inside of the molecule, and it follows the base pairing rules. What are the base pairing rules for DNA? Yeah, AT and GC, because of the shape of the molecules, but also the number of hydrogen bonds of these of the bases. So these are what we, GC, AT, are what we call complementary bases. All right, so furthermore, when the two DNA strands base pair together, right, that actually forms this alpha helix right here. That allows the alpha helix to form. All right, so don't forget about the law of complementary base pairing. All right. So what is the big difference between RNA and DNA? There's not a big difference between them. The building blocks are nucleotides, right? But in DNA, we use deoxyribose. Notice that there is an oxygen missing in this position right here. But in RNA, it's using the ribose sugar, which does have an oxygen in that position. All right, so that's one of the bigger differences. The other difference is that in RNA, we never find thymine. Instead of thymine, we have uracil. All right, so that's the other big difference. So for RNA, the base pairing rules are, all right, GC is still same. GC is what we find in DNA, and that's what we have in RNA. But instead of, in DNA, we have AT, but in RNA, it can't be AT because there is no thymine. The base pairing rules are going to be A and uracil. And uracil is going to have a very similar kind of shape and structure to it so that it can base pair easily with adenine. All right, so the base pairing rules in RNA are GC and AU because uracil replaces thymine. Another important difference between RNA and DNA is DNA is double-stranded, right? And RNA is single-stranded. I don't know if I have a picture of a single strand of DNA, but RNA is not double-stranded. And we'll see why that is in a little bit. Okay, so let's just go over some things that we're talking about so far. Building block of a polysaccharide is a monosaccharide. Give me an example of a monosaccharide. Yeah, like glucose. Okay. What's the building block of a triglyceride? Three fatty acids and glycerol. Building block of a protein is, or are amino acids. And maybe you could give me some examples of amino acids. Maybe not too important in here, but does anybody know a name of an amino acid just for fun? Tyrosine is one. We saw that on the slide. Yeah, tyrosine is a really good one. I'll mention that later. All right, and what's the building block, the fourth class of organic compounds? What's the building block of DNA? DNA. It's going to be a nucleotide, okay? But in particular, it's going to be what? That deoxyribonucleotide. Right, and the building block for RNA is going to be a ribonucleotide. And who could give me a name of, for sure, a specific ribonucleotide? Or what kind of base? What kind of base is going to be specific to a ribonucleotide? Uracil, right. And a base that is specific only to a deoxyribonucleotide. That's going to be thymine. Right? Okay. So don't forget, RNA is always going to be single-stranded. And your body makes three different kinds. We're just going to talk about three kinds of RNA in this class.
And they're called messenger RNA, transfer RNA, and ribosomal RNA. And let me see, maybe I want to go, that's it for that slide. Or for this. Okay, I guess I'll stop after talking about this slide right here before I go on to the next chapter. And that is what RNA is used for and what DNA is used for. RNA and DNA are used to make proteins, right? So DNA determines the structure of your body, but also determines how your body is going to function. So there is information in DNA that is used to make proteins. And there are three different kinds of RNA that are necessary for protein synthesis to take place. And when you bake a cake, how do you bake a cake? How do you start? How would you start making a cake, for instance? Mixing stuff up, eggs. So do you like mix things up inside the oven, or where do you mix things up? Okay. Do you turn the oven on and then start mixing things up in the oven? No, where do you start mixing things up? Like on the countertop someplace, right? That's where you actually mix all the ingredients together. And for protein synthesis, there is a place, right? There's a special organelle that's responsible for making proteins, and you think of that as the workbench, right? And that's going to be a ribosome, and the kind of RNA that makes up a ribosome is called ribosomal RNA. So our RNA is the workbench for protein synthesis. All right, and so when you make a protein, you need the building blocks. What are the building blocks again for protein? Amino acids. So in order for ribosomes to make a protein, it needs amino acids. So something has to bring amino acids to a ribosome in order to make a protein. So it needs a taxi to get from various places in the cell to a ribosome. And there's another kind of RNA that does that. And that's the transfer RNA. You could say, well, that's taxi RNA. It brings amino acids to the ribosome to make a protein. All right, but don't forget, in order to make a protein, you have to put amino acids together in the right order in order to get the correct kind of protein. You just can't randomly put amino acids together because you'll just get a random protein and it might not have any function whatsoever. So there has to be instructions for the ribosome on what amino acids should be put next to each other in sequence. And that's the job of the messenger RNA. That's the blueprint for determining the primary structure of a protein. What's the primary structure of a protein again? It's just a sequence of amino acids, right? And we're going to see how that relates to, or what that relates to the primary sequence of a nucleic acid. Just the order of nucleotides in DNA determines the order of amino acids in a protein. So those are the three kinds of RNA that we're going to look at. All right. Let's see if I can get that internet connection. What happened to it? All right, so what's our next chapter? Okay, chapter 3. Oh, isn't that nice? Looks like it's working. So I'm kind of confused about something. You can help me out. I want to make a DNA molecule, and I've got nucleotides, and I don't know how to put the nucleotides together. What kind of reaction can I use to put nucleotides together? Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. So I'll just do a dehydration synthesis reaction. That should work.
Let's see if that link works. Oh, thank goodness it's working, okay. All right, so this chapter is pretty easy because there's a lot of review from anatomy. Hopefully I don't spend a lot of time on anatomy in here. All right, we're going to look at some basic parts of the cell, like the plasma membrane, cytoplasm, some organelles. We'll talk about gene expression a little bit, DNA replication, and maybe a little bit about the cell cycle. Okay, the plasma membrane separates the internal components of the cell from the extracellular world. And inside the cell are all the living processes, and outside the cell are non-living processes. So the cell membrane is very important. All right? The cell membrane also allows certain things that the cells need to enter, and it helps in the secretion or transport of materials that might be harmful to the cell to the outside, getting rid of toxic compounds. And I like the concept of building block a lot. And that is, the cell can be considered a building block for something. Right? It's a structural and functional unit of something, and what it is a building block for is life. And that means that if anything is alive, it has to be cellular in nature. It's got to be a cell. And in order for something to be a cell, it's got to have a plasma membrane, it's got to have cytoplasm, and it's got to have nuclear material or genetic material. And genetic material could be DNA, and we also know now that genetic material can even be RNA. So a cell has got to have cytoplasm and genetic material. And so bacteria fall into that classification. A bacterium doesn't have a nucleus, but it just has a chromosome floating around in the cytoplasm. And it has enzymes in the cytoplasm that can undergo the living processes. And it's got a membrane that separates it from the outside world. So a bacterium is a living system. And as such, bacteria sometimes are very easy to defeat in somebody that hasn't been infected with them. Because since they're alive, what can you do to a bacterium? You can kill it with antibiotics, right? Okay. As opposed to other kinds of infectious particles, for instance, like a virus. A virus has genetic material inside a protein coat, but it doesn't have a plasma membrane, and it does not have cytoplasm. A virus really is more like a crystal that's made out of DNA or RNA and some proteins. So if a virus is not alive, right, and you become infected with that virus, can it be treated just by killing that virus? Well, you can't kill something that's not alive, right? So viral infections are much more difficult to treat because they're not really a living system that can be disrupted as easily as a living system. All right, so I want you to know that all cells are the building block of life, or cells are the building block of life, just like the building block of a protein is amino acid, right? Life depends on cells. Right? And a cell is a highly organized, at least our cells, are a highly organized molecular factory that has a plasma membrane, right? It's got cytoplasm, right? And then it also has all these organelles. So we're going to talk about the organelles inside of a cell. So you make sure that you can recognize an organelle by its shape, right? And also by its function. We're first going to start to talk about the plasma membrane. And the basic structure of a plasma membrane is this phospholipid bilayer.
right? So can you see why it's a bilayer? What do we see on the inside of the membrane, this internal part of a cell membrane right here? What part? Yeah, that's a big hydrophobic region. So would we find a lot of water right in this region right here? No, water is going to be excluded, right? Because this is a nonpolar realm. Water can't get through this area right here. This is the lipid part of the plasma membrane. And then what are these balls again? These are the phosphate groups, right? This is the hydrophilic part of the membrane. And so on either side of the plasma membrane will be an aqueous or water solution. And so the membrane is very, very stable. All right, the phospholipid bilayer all by itself does not have a lot of integrity. It's a very weak kind of structure. It's a very fluid kind of structure because there's really nothing gluing these phospholipid molecules together. It can flow. You could think of maybe if you took some oil and put a drop of oil on a glass of water or something, it would flow over the whole surface of that glass of water. And if you were to jiggle the glass of water, that oil layer would jiggle right with the water. It wouldn't fracture or bend or break away from the surface of the water. Cell membranes are very fluid as well, right? But cell membranes are given rigidity because that's important. If cell membranes were very, very fluid, right, then if you were to stand up, all of your plasma membranes would just run out on the floor. So cell membranes have to have some rigidity to them. So what happens here is that there's another lipid that can be placed within the phospholipid bilayer right in this hydrophobic region right here to give some rigidity to the plasma membrane. And these molecules are cholesterol. So how would you describe why cholesterol can exist in the interior part of this plasma membrane? Why is that? Because it's nonpolar, right? It's hydrophobic as well. So this is a great place for cholesterol to hang out because it's with its own nature right here with the long fatty acids that are on the interior of the membrane. All right, and also to give other function, well, I tell you what, since there's this large hydrophobic region on the inside of this plasma membrane, things that are polar, for instance, like water, like sodium ions or any kind of ion, they can't move across the membrane, right? Because this hydrophobic region is going to exclude them from moving across the membrane. So a cell membrane is not permeable to everything. Only certain things can go across the membrane. And the only things that can freely go across the membrane are those that have some solubility in lipids. So nonpolar compounds can actually cross the cell membrane without any kind of special help. Cell membranes have certain kinds of identifier markers placed in them. For instance, if something happens to your heart and it dies and you need to have it replaced and you get a transplant heart, if somebody transplants a heart, you get a transplant, it could be a cornea or a heart or a lung or kidney or whatever, what is your body going to try to do to that transplanted organ? It's going to try to reject it. So your body knows that that organ doesn't belong to you. It doesn't know that it really belongs there to keep you alive. It just knows that all those cells don't belong to you. And the reason why it knows is because on the cell membrane, there are certain signature molecules or address molecules or recognition molecules, right? And we call those things antigens. And they are proteins that have sugar molecules bound to them. And these sugar molecules can have different branching patterns, right? So, you know, this one kind of looks like this one here and this one over here. So all the cells in your body have the exact same shape of a particular antigen. So all those cells look exactly the same. And your brothers and sisters will have antigens on their cells, and they'll have a little bit different shape to them, all right? And then your cousins will have antigens, and they'll have even a little bit more different shape. And as you move from, say, the human species to other kinds of species, the shape of those sugar molecules are going to change more and more and more, so that if a cell that doesn't belong to you enters your body, it doesn't have the right shape for these molecules, and your immune system knows that that cell doesn't belong to you, and will mount a a response to kill that cell, which is going to reject that organ from your body. Okay, so not only is the plasma membrane just a fluid structure that provides for a separation between the inside world and the outside world, but it has other things embedded in it, like antigens. And there can be other proteins that go all the way across the membrane, like this one right here, and some of these proteins can have a channel in them. Right? So if water can't go across this phospholipid bilayer because of this lipid region right here, if there is a channel made by this protein, now water can actually go from one side of the cell to the other because of that channel. Right? Other polar compounds like sodium and potassium can't normally go across the cell membrane, but if there's a protein embedded in the membrane that has a channel for sodium, now sodium can go back and forth across the membrane. And some of these channels will actually have a door or a gate on them so that the cell can actually control when sodium goes back or potassium goes back and forth across the cell membrane. Right? So a cell membrane can have identifier proteins or carbohydrates on them, which we call antigens. It can have channels. It can have gated channels. There can be other proteins that promote certain kinds of chemical reactions. We would call that an enzyme. So plasma membranes can have enzymes embedded in them. And plasma membrane can also have other kinds of proteins that can sense signaling molecules, maybe certain kinds of hormones or other kinds of neurotransmitters from neurons embedded in them, so they can receive signals from other kinds of cells. So the plasma membrane is important for communication between cells as well. So if we think of the plasma membrane, its basic structure is very fluid because of the phospholipid bilayer, right? The easiest way that we can think, or the simplest way we can think of any kind of membrane, whether it's a cell membrane or a membrane around an organelle, is that it is a phospholipid bilayer. And I think last time I showed you how phospholipid layers just automatically form, right? Just spontaneously form. Right, so these membranes spontaneously form. The simplest way to think about a membrane is a phospholipid bilayer, but a more sophisticated way of appreciating a cell membrane is that it is not just a phospholipid bilayer, but there are other things that are added to it, like cholesterol for rigidity or stability, markers or antigens for identification, channels for transport across the membrane. What else? Enzymes for allowing certain chemical reactions to take place, and receptors for communication between cells. So the best way to think of a cell membrane is, of course, to understand the fluid nature of it, but also that it has all these other components, and we call that the mosaic nature of a plasma membrane. We join those two concepts together and say that a plasma membrane is best, or the best way to think of a plasma membrane is by using what we call the fluid mosaic model, right? Fluid mosaic model. The fluid part comes from the phospholipid bilayer. The mosaic part comes from all those different kinds of proteins and sugar molecules that can be added to it to give additional function to the plasma membrane for transport, recognition, and communication. Right, and some of those proteins can be sugar proteins, or they can be even glycolipids, sugar lipids. The other thing about a plasma membrane is that, let's see if I can go back, don't have it on this diagram, but we see some proteins that can go all the way across the membrane, and there are other proteins that now can attach to that are all intracellular inside the cell that attach to these integral proteins that are attached to the cell membrane. And those are what we call microtubules and microfilaments. And they can push and pull on these integral proteins right here in the cell membrane. All right, so when the microfilaments push and pull on this protein, what happens to the shape of the membrane right here? It can be pulled in or it can be pushed out. And that's what the cytoskeleton is used for. All right, so here we see a cell, a living cell, actually changing its shape, right, because the microtubules inside the cell are pulling and pushing on the membrane and causing its shape to change. And this is one way for a cell to transport material across the cell membrane. So here might be some kind of food particle, or maybe this could be an infectious bacterium that this immune cell wants to destroy, and it bumps into it, and it will surround this particular particle and eventually completely surround it, not just in two dimensions, but in what, three dimensions, completely surround it. So now this particle, whatever it is, food particle or infectious particle, is now really inside the cell. Right? It's inside the cell, is really no longer outside the cell. So that's an example of bulk transport. It's a way that a cell can move large molecules or particles across the plasma membrane. And we would call this particular case of bulk transport phagocytosis, right? Because we can actually see this particle right here. Phago just means eating, and cytosis just means some kind of cellular process. And so here, this is an example of a nice macrophage or a white blood cell eating this particle up. And then once inside the cell, it can combine with other kinds of enzymes that will destroy it and then prevent the infection of your body. All right, so here we see the cell changing shape. ATP is required for this process. So this process is what we call an active transport process because it requires energy. It's not a passive transport process. Phagocytosis is active transport. There's another similar kind of process where the cell changes shape, and there might not be a solid particle in this area right here, but it just might be fluid with something dissolved in it, maybe like glucose. So instead of cell eating, we call that cell drinking. Okay, and so that's what we term pinocytosis. So pinocytosis is just a little bit different than phagocytosis. It is still active transport, and it is still moving material from outside to inside the cell. So whenever there's a process that moves something from extracellular to intracellular, we call that endocytosis. And all endocytosis processes are active processes that require ATP because we have to have microfilaments and microtubules sliding past each other on the inside of the cell. Okay, the opposite of that, right? So let's just start with a particle inside the cell, or maybe a solution of material inside of a vesicle inside the cell. That vesicle can move over to the plasma membrane. It hops a ride on the microtubule system, and that vesicle fuses to the cell membrane, and then that particle is released to the outside. So it's the reverse sequence that you see on this slide. So we would call that exocytosis. Right, that's when the cell export products into the extracellular fluid via secretory vesicles. Right, so I think you've run into some of these terms already in anatomy, and probably these structures as well. There are some structures on the surface of the cell that have a microtubule and microfilament system in them as well. Right, and these are cilia, flagella, and microvilli. Cilia and flagella are kind of similar. They're not on your diagram of the cell, but cilia and flagella can change their shape. They can bend and sweep. And so since these structures are long and filamentous and sweep over the surface of the cell, they're important for motility. Right? And there's only one cell in the human body that has a flagellum, and that is a sperm, which is one very, very long whip-like appendage on a sperm cell that whips back and forth that can propel a sperm cell through any kind of watery environment. We have many cells that have cilia. Unicellular organisms can use cilia just like a sperm can use flagella to move around. Right? They can swim around in their environment when all the cilia are beating in a certain way. But the cells in our body that have cilia are anchored next to other cells, so they can't swim around. And there are cells that have cilia, and I think you've learned this in anatomy, there are cells that have cilia that line your trachea, and all those cilia are sweeping or beating in one direction. Do you think they're beating up or beating down? Okay. And the reason why they are there is because there is mucus in that lining. It's a pseudo-stratified ciliated columnar epithelium, right? And it releases mucus onto the surface of your trachea so that when you inhale air and it has dust particles, those dust particles get trapped in the mucus, and the cilia then take the mucus with dust particles and sweep it up, right? Not down into your lungs, because that would plug your lungs up. Your lungs are a dead-end space. It sweeps them up into your pharynx. And when it's in your pharynx, then what do? You just swallow it down. Get rid of them that way. Unless you're a baseball player, and then what do? Then you spit it out. Yeah, all day long. Okay? So cilia are important for motility. Okay, not because they move around, but because they move stuff over the surface, for instance, of an epithelium. All right. Well, I think we're going to have to take a break. So tell me to start here next time. Microvilli. Microvilli don't move or sweep or beat like a cilium or a flagellum. They're there for another reason. All right, so that's where we're going to start next time. Oh, I didn't pass the sign-in sheet around. I think we might be okay, though. I tell you what, can I put it out? Can you sign it on your way out? Sign-out sheet. Maybe, I tell you what, let's put it right here. Let's put it right here. Yeah, by Saturday. Maybe Friday.
Okay, and then yeah. After. For the study guide?
Yeah, I got to get on that. Yeah.